and those are universality, or universal, and transversal. And so we're concerned with universality because, of course, we want to implement quantum algorithms on a quantum computer. But constructing encoded unitaries for quantum error correcting codes, which are likely required to suppress noise in a quantum computer, is a challenging task. And so normally we're forced to choose a finite set of gates, which can then efficiently approximate the arbitrary unitaries that we need for a quantum algorithm. Now, transversal gates are a particularly nice, simple and desirable method for implementing encoded gates in a quantum error correcting code. But until now, combining transversality with universality has been, let's say, a bit tricky. So today, what I'm going to show is that with the help of error correction, which is necessary anyway, that transversality and universality can actually play together pretty nicely. Okay. So fault tolerance. So as many of you, I'm sure, probably know, quantum computers are highly susceptible to noise. Quantum error correcting codes can help protect quantum information from errors by using many physical qubits to encode a single logical qubit. But we have to be careful that the computational data that we're working with is protected at all times. And so fault tolerance is the study of how to maintain this constant error protection against errors by performing computation while these logical bits are encoded. And so roughly speaking, there's two concepts that we need to be concerned with in fault tolerance. And that is, first of all, how do we perform computation on these logical bits that are encoded? And second of all, errors can accumulate during these encoded gates. How do we recover from these errors? How do we eliminate them from the system as we go? And so the question is, given some set of physical gates that are provided to us by the actual quantum computer, how can we actually build these boxes here, these encoded gates and these error correction boxes? And so a little bit later on, I'll talk a little bit about how error correction works. But for the most part during this talk, we're going to be concerned about these with these encoded gate boxes, these boxes in blue here. OK, so our goal is to implement these encoded gates. And in particular, we want some encoded version of a unitary, U, say. Now, the simplest possible procedure that we could plausibly hope to do is to implement this encoded version of U by just doing a physical version of U on each of the physical qubits in our error correcting code. And so a gate that can be performed in this way, where a physical gate is performed on each one of the, and at most one of the physical qubits in the code, is called a transversal gate. And as I said before, transversal gates are particularly simple and they're particularly desirable, mainly because, well, one, they're very simple. But more importantly, transversal gates don't spread errors very quickly. So what do I mean by that? Well, say, for example, that there's an error on the first qubit of the code, say an X error before we implement this transversal gate. The transversal gate only acts on a single qubit, and so this X error will propagate through this unitary and wouldn't spread to any of these other qubits in the code. Now, on the other hand, let's say we had a C0 gate between these two qubits here so that they interact. Well, in that case, this X error will propagate not only to not only on the qubit that it was on originally, but also propagates then to the target of the C0 as well. And so now we have a code word here that has a weight 2 error rather than just a weight 1 error, which might not be correctable by the code that we're using. So it'd be wonderful if we could just do this transversal implementation for all of the gates that we needed to do for some universal set of gates. But unfortunately, it turns out that this isn't possible. So Easton and Knill in 2009 showed that there's no quantum code, or at least no non-trivial quantum code, that admits a transversal implementation of a universal set of gates. Okay, so in order to approximate an arbitrary unitary, which we want to do for quantum algorithms, we're going to need at least one encoded operation that can't be implemented transversally. Okay, so how do we implement these non-transversal gates? There's a number of different ways that we can do it, but the most popular method is something called state distillation. And so in state distillation, basically the goal is to take some number of noisy resource states, which I'm just calling A here, performing some complicated circuit and doing some measurements, and then hopefully at the end of the day we get some slightly some copy of this resource state that has higher fidelity than the ones that we started with. And we can then use this resource state using a technique called gate teleportation to actually implement the unitary that we want. So the specifics of how state distillation works in this circuit in particular are not important right now. But the point that I want to make, though, is that state distillation it's complicated and it's costly in terms of the number of resources that we need in order to actually implement these fault tolerantly. And it turns out, depending on the architecture and depending on other kinds of things, state distillation is often about an order of magnitude more expensive than would be a transversal implementation of a gate, for example. So the Easton-Knill theorem is really kind of a big bummer. I mean, we like to implement everything transversely because it's very simple, but we're stuck with basically the state distillation technique, which is very costly. Okay, but so I'm here today. The message of today, yeah, right.
Do you remember what are the assumptions of the theorem? At some point, I talked to Manny, and then he said to me he was not 100% sure that it was watertight. So do you remember?
Well, I guess maybe I'm exposing some of those leaks then today. I don't know, but so the more specific statement of the theorem is something to the effect of there exists no quantum code of any kind, stabilizer code or whatever, that can detect an error on any physical subsystem and admits a universal set of transversal gates. So I don't think that there are any other, I don't remember any other assumptions other than that, you know, what's made in that particular statement. So it's a fairly conclusive statement. And so what I'm going to show today doesn't falsify that statement, doesn't contradict it. It's really more of just sidestepping the theorem. So we'll see that as I go. So I guess the key assumption that they don't make, or they don't assume that there's any error correction involved. And so basically what I'm going to show today is that if you also include error correction, which of course is necessary anyway, right? It's just the basic error correction procedure that you would use with these codes in the first place. When you include that, then you actually can get a universal set of gates which is transversal with the help of error correction. So we shouldn't be so depressed about this Easton-Knill theorem in the first place. Maybe there's some hope. Okay, so let me demonstrate how this works and with an example. That's the easiest way to see what's actually happening here. So the example that I'm going to use is the 15.1.3 quantum error correcting code. So the notation here just means that this is a code that uses 15 physical qubits to encode a single logical qubit and to a distance of 3, which basically just means that this code can correct an arbitrary error on any one of the physical qubits. And so this 15.1.3 code is based on a classical error correcting code, the 15-bit Hamming code. And all of the, so each of the code words of the 15-bit Hamming code satisfy a set of parity checks, which are shown here. I guess my laser pointer is going up. So there's a set of four parity checks that each of these code words has to satisfy. So just for example, one of the code words is the all zero string here. And the reason that that's a code word is because if you take the bitwise inner product of the all zero string with any of these parity checks, you just get the all zero string, which has even parity. Okay? And similarly, if you take the bitwise inner product with the all one string, well, since there are eight ones in each of these parity checks, the result is a vector that has weight 8, which is also even and satisfies all the parity checks. And there's a number of other code words as well. So to turn this in, so we're not interested in classical codes, we're interested in quantum codes. So in order to turn this into a quantum code, what we do is we take all of the ones in these parity checks and turn them into poly-X operators, and turn all the zeros and turn them into identity operators, which just for visual clarity, I just denote as a dot. And there's also a slight change in terminology. Instead of parity checks, we refer to these as stabilizers. Okay? And so the code words of the quantum code are a little bit more complicated than just these bit strings that we had for the classical code. And so what we normally do is, instead of writing the code words out explicitly, what we do is we define a logical operator, the logical X operator here, which is just the poly X on each of the individual physical qubits in the code. And so what this poly X operator does is it acts like a poly X operator on a physical qubit. That is, it takes the encoded version of ket 0 and flips it to ket 1 and vice versa. It acts just like poly X would. Okay, but qubits also have phase information, of course. And so in addition to X stabilizers, the quantum code also contains a number of Z stabilizers. And so the requirement here is that each of these X stabilizers should commute with all of the Z stabilizers. And for the 15.1.3 code, it turns out that, well, some of the Z stabilizers are just essentially identical to the X stabilizers. But then there's also a few extra ones up here that I've labeled in orange. Okay, so. Before we go any further, just a few notable properties of the 15.1.3 code that are going to be important to us. And that is that, well, the CNOT gate is transversal for the 15.1.3 code. And this is nothing really that novel. The CNOT gate is transversal for most of the well-known codes, including the 7-qubit code, the 9-qubit code, and any other codes that are called CSS codes. But what's notable about the 15.1.3 code is that the T gate, the single qubit T gate, is transversal. And so here, what I mean by the T gate is just a pi over 4 rotation about the Z axis.
So the Hadamard is not transversal for this one?
That's a good question.
I'll pay you later, Richard. The answer is it depends. So I'm going to show you actually that it is transversal, but let me show you first of all why it's not transversal. Okay, so I should first of all mention that CNOT and T are not universal for quantum computing. We need an extra gate, and in particular, if we add the Hadamard gate, we do get a universal set of gates, and so that's why we should be interested in whether or not the Hadamard is transversal for this code. So essentially, the Easton-Knill theorem tells us that the Hadamard can't possibly be transversal, because otherwise it would be a contradiction. Okay, so let's see why that is. So first of all, how does H transform this code? So what it does, H has the effect. When you apply an operator to a physical qubit, what this does to the stabilizers is it conjugates each of the operators by, in this case, the Hadamard gate. And so what happens is, each of these X operators are going to be transformed to Z, and each of the Zs are going to be transformed to Xs. So they just get swapped. So if we apply physical Hadamard to each of the physical qubits just transversally, then what happens is we swap the stabilizers here that are shown in black. Okay, X goes to Z, Z goes to X. And in fact, this is exactly what we want to have happen from a logical Hadamard. We really, in particular, we want the X logical operator here to go to the Z logical operator, which is exactly what happens. And we want the Z logical operator to go to the X logical operator. So far, things look pretty good. But the problem is these extra Z stabilizers up here. So what about those? So those are also going to get flipped to X stabilizers. But now, this is not the same code that we started with. Right? The code that we want has all the Z stabilizers here, but this is not the same thing. But I mean, you can see that, well, it's not, the code isn't so much different than what we started with. Right? It's just a matter of fixing up these X stabilizers here. And so one of the key ingredients of this main result that Hadamard is essentially transversal is that we can restore the original Z stabilizers using just a process which is part of the standard error correction technique. And that is just to measure the stabilizers. Okay, so the procedure here is going to be for every one of these Z stabilizers that we want to restore, just perform that measurement in whichever way you would normally do for error correction. And now the result of that measurement is just going to be a classical plus or minus result. And so that has the effect of adding this operator back to, it projects the quantum state back into a state in which this operator is now again a stabilizer of the code, up to some plus or minus one phase. Okay, and at the same time, this measurement, you can see that this operator here, it anti-commutes with, in this case, it happens to be this X operator here. And so since we require that all the stabilizers commute, what that means is that this X operator just is no longer part of the stabilizer of the code. It disappears. And so of course, we can repeat that process for all of the Z stabilizers that we want to restore. And then we just have these plus or minus one phases to deal with. But it turns out that this is not a problem. If we want to get rid of, say we get a minus one result for one of these stabilizers here, then there's just some set of single qubit poly X operators that we can apply to reverse that phase and make it a plus phase again. And so now we've restored the code. We've done exactly what we wanted to do. The X and the Z operators have been swapped, and all the stabilizers are the same as they were before. And so we're now back in the original code space that we want to be in. So the net effect then is that, well, C0 and T are still transversal, of course, and it looks like Hadamard is also transversal, assuming that we also have this ability to measure the stabilizer, these Z stabilizers here. Okay, so that's universality, right? So we have transversal gates. When we include error correction, we have a universal set of gates.
When you apply the X's there, is that transversal within one of the two codes? Or?
So the corrections are always going to be tensor products of poly X operators. And so and they're going to be applied conditioned on the classical measurement information that we have. So in fact, yes, they are. So they are transversal, although they are dependent on the measurement outcomes, right? The syndrome measurement outcomes that we get from the error correction procedure. But this is entirely standard. I mean, this is what happens in normal error correction anyway, right? So for example, the entire error correction process would also include measuring all of these black Z operators.
So if you're working just within one of those two codes, you'd be able to do that X anyway.
That's right. Now, there is a subtle difference which I don't really want to get into. It doesn't affect the transversality, but it has to do with something called the polyframe. In this case, normally you can use the polyframe and not actually have to perform these corrections explicitly. It's a little bit different in this case. But everything is still transversal, and the general procedure is exactly the same as you would normally have. Okay, so at this point, the objection that I would expect, and maybe that some of you have, is something to the effect of, okay, sure, you've restored the original code, But you had to go outside of the original, the code space that you were in order to do it, right? So isn't the whole point of fault tolerance that you stay in the code space the entire time? The quantum information has to be protected at all times. Okay, so the answer is yes, that's true. That is a valid objection. But in this case, everything is actually okay. And so what happens is, it turns out that even when we go into this other code, the minimum distance of this code is still preserved. That is, the minimum distance of the code that this code where we had the X operators is exactly the same as the minimum distance of the code where we have the Z operators. And the reason for this is that, well, these X stabilizers here provide protection against Z errors for us, right? They can correct an arbitrary Z error on any one of the physical qubits. Okay, that's distance 3. But, okay, so we have a bunch of extra Z stabilizers, but those actually provide a higher protection, a larger amount of protection against X errors. In fact, there's a distance 7 here for the 15.1.3 code for X errors. It's just that we're reporting a minimum distance of 3 because that's the lowest common denominator here. And so when we swap between the two, we don't actually lose anything in terms of the minimum distance. We do lose something in terms of we're swapping increased X protection for increased Z protection. And in principle, it is possible to take advantage of this extra protection against X errors. So say, for some reason, your physical quantum computer was more likely to produce X errors, well, then you might want to use a code like this. Okay, but in practice, it's actually somewhat difficult to take advantage of that kind of thing. And so, in most cases, we're probably not taking advantage of this extra X protection in the first place, so we might as well use it for something more useful. And in this case, what we're doing is we're trading this extra distance for the ability to do a transversal Hadamard gate. Okay, that's my intuition anyway. Okay, so this is the end of the example. It's probably a good, if there's any questions about the example, it's probably a good time to ask. Otherwise, I'll move on.
Could you say a little bit? Those Zs up on top, I mean, I don't see the structure between them. I mean,
So
you can't say much.
The requirement is that all the stabilizers have to commute. And so the way that I obtained all these Z stabilizers was by taking, go back to the representation where all these Xs are ones and all the dots are zeros. Yeah. And then take the orthogonal complement of that. Right. So this is subspace. Take the orthogonal complement of that. And this then is a basis for that or the orthogonal complement. Okay, when you include, you have to also include this logical X operator. So that's how you obtain them. I don't know if I can say more about the structure than that, other than there is another way to look at the 15.1.3 code, and that is as a 15.7.3 code, where it encodes 7 logical qubits. And in that case, what you do is the black operators here are your stabilizers. You then have the same logical operators below, but then you also include these Zs as logical operators for the extra 6 qubits.
Well, there's more that you can say, actually, about this structure. It's maybe not so obvious in this presentation, but the codes here are Reed-Muller codes. So there's could be a choice of parity checks here that, the bottom 4 are just like, you know, 1 bit of a number written as in binary, and then the top one.
If you look at the columns of these, this is 1.
Yeah. Right.
2, 3.
Yeah. And then the top 6, in some choice, could be like the products of 2 bits of the number written in binary.
How does this affect the threshold?
Okay, so it depends on your noise model. So like I said, if you have a noise model where X errors are much more likely than Z errors, and you are using that fact, right, you're using this distance 7 protection against X errors, if you were actually using that, then of course the threshold is going to come down. But the fact of the matter is, the threshold studies that I know of, for this code anyway, they don't use that fact. They just use the minimum distance and assume, you know, like a depolarizing kind of channel. Now, I mean, of course, there are other studies that look at biased noise. In that case, I guess that the threshold would come down. But I think normally that this code is not used for that particular purpose, as far as I know.
But people who looked at the threshold for that code didn't use that construction. Probably use horribly big construction with magic states or something like this.
You would have to examine the threshold in terms of, in this case, like concatenation of this code. That's right. Normally what happens is this code is actually used with other codes to perform magic state distillation. That's right.
Is it possible to do a gate teleportation implementation of the Hadamard, given that you have C0 always the T gate?
It is. So that's true. So that's another way that you could sort of get around this Easton-Knill theorem in this particular case. And maybe at the very end, I'm not really going to talk about it, but I'll give you a reference to an example where that's one way that they say that you can do this. So it's sort of a subtle difference then. In that case, what you're really saying is you're doing sort of a different kind of state distillation. It's not, you know, you're not distilling this state that you need for a T gate. You're distilling essentially the ket plus. Right, in order to perform the Hadamard. Now, in many respects, that's an easier task because ket plus is a stabilizer state. On the other hand, it's something extra in addition to error correction. Right? So there's still some extra overhead involved with how do you prepare that ket plus state in the first place, and how do you do so in a fault-tolerant way. So the answer is yes, and there is a subtle difference between the way that I'm presenting it and the way that it would be done if you used a distillation method like that. Okay, any other questions? Okay, so that was an example for the 15.1.3 code. But it turns out that this construction actually works for a much wider class of codes, and those are called triorthogonal codes. So let me just briefly explain what a triorthogonal code is. So triorthogonal codes are based on a binary matrices, which are also called triorthogonal. And a matrix is considered triorthogonal if it satisfies two conditions. First of all, each pair of rows should have an overlap which has even weight. And the second condition is very similar. Each triple of rows should have an overlap, which also has even weight. Okay.
So that what you mean by the triple overlap is where all three of them are one.
That's right. So when you take the bitwise binary, the bitwise inner product, right, the bitwise product of the binary vectors, and then take the Hamming weight of the result. Right. So we've already seen an example of a triorthogonal matrix. It's the one based on the 15-bit Hamming code, not surprisingly. Okay, so you can see here, for example, if you take the first and the second row, they overlap in the first four positions here, the rightmost four positions, which is even, and therefore that pair satisfies this top condition here. And you can check that all pairs and all triples satisfy these conditions if you want to. Okay, so triorthogonal codes, the idea of a triorthogonal matrix was introduced by Ravi and Ha just last year. And what they showed was that you can build a stabilizer code, just like the one that I showed for the 15.1.3 code, out of any triorthogonal matrix. And what you do is you take every even weight row and turn it into an X stabilizer. Okay, so for example, you could take this top row here and turn all the ones into poly X's, just like we did for the 15.1.3 code. And then the logical operators correspond to the odd weight rows of your matrix. Okay, so in this case, this is our odd weight row. which in the 15-qubit code just corresponded to poly x on all the physical qubits. The z stabilizers are slightly more complicated. What you do is, like I said before, you take the orthogonal complement of this matrix G and then take all of the even weight rows of that result. And those are going to be your z stabilizers. OK, so in addition to the 15-1-3 code that we already saw, Ravi and Ha also give some explicit constructions of a couple of additional triorthogonal codes. There's one 49-1-5 code, so this code encodes a single logical qubit into 49 physical qubits, and it has a slightly higher distance of 5, so it can correct any two errors. And they also give a family of triorthogonal codes where the number of physical bits is 3k plus 8, where k is the number of logical bits that you're actually encoding. And the distance 2 just means that it can't correct any errors, but it can detect any arbitrary error. And finally, what they show is that for any triorthogonal code based on this construction here, that code admits a transversal T-gate, sort of. In some cases, it's just flat-out transversal T, like for the 15-1-3 code. In other cases, you sometimes need these Clifford gate corrections. Okay. So in a similar vein, what I'm going to claim is that triorthogonal codes admit a transversal version of the Hadamard using the construction that we just saw, so transversal Hadamard plus error correction. And they also admit a straight transversal implementation of the doubly controlled Z gate. Okay, so the doubly controlled Z gate, I'll define it formally in a minute, but you can define it this way, where if you have the Toffoli gate here, the doubly controlled Z gate can be obtained just by conjugating the target qubit with Hadamard gates. And the nice thing about this is that back in 2003, Yunwan Shi showed that Toffoli and Hadamard together form a universal set of gates, just like C0T and Hadamard that we saw before. And so therefore, if we have doubly controlled Z in Hadamard, we also have a universal set of gates by this equivalence here. OK, so first I'll sketch the proof for Hadamard, and then I'll move on to the doubly controlled Z gate. OK, so the claim is that the encoded Hadamard gate on the left is equivalent to transversal Hadamard plus error correction. So the proof for that is it's precisely what we saw for the 15-1-3 code. OK, so here are the X stabilizers and the Z stabilizers. And again, so what we have are the X logical operators and the Z logical operators are essentially identical. And they also share some number of stabilizers. But then there's also some number of extra Z stabilizers that are going to give us problems when we perform the Hadamard. But the procedure to correct that is exactly the same. So for every one of these stabilizers up here, we just measure that stabilizer. And if we get a minus one outcome, then there's some tensor product of poly X that we can make to correct that phase and to bring it back into the code space. And again, importantly, the same argument with minimum distance also still holds. And so we're protected at all times, regardless of which code space we're in. OK, so that's transversal Hadamard. The transversal doubly controlled Z gate is a little bit more mathematical. And in order to understand how it works, we're going to have to know what the structure of these code words that I haven't shown before. OK, so in order to figure out what the code words of a triorthogonal code look like, first of all, let's simplify things a little bit. So let's consider a triorthogonal code that just encodes a single logical qubit. All of this works in the case where there are multiple encoded qubits, but there's no need for that kind of complication. So we'll label that single logical operator here, the single odd weight row of our triorthogonal matrix, as F star. Okay. And then all the even weight rows, well, the linear span of all this, where I'm going to denote by G0 here. And then I'll also define another set of binary vectors, which is just the coset of the left coset of G0 with F star, right? So that's essentially what this is doing is G0 is the set of all of the X stabilizers of the code. And G1 corresponds to all of the X stabilizers multiplied by the logical X operator. Okay? And so what that means is that the encoded version of ket 0 for this code is just equal to the superposition over all of these the elements of G0 here. Okay, so the superposition over all of the X stabilizers, essentially. And then encoded ket 1 is just likewise the superposition over all of the elements of G1, where we've now multiplied by the logical X operator. Okay, so now we can actually look at how the proof works. So what we want to do is we're applying the transversal doubly controlled Z gate to some basis state here, ABC. And so now, based on this definition here, we can write down that code word on three qubits as just a sum over all of these elements of GA, GB, and GC. And then the effect of the transversal doubly controlled Z gate is just defined by this here, where we add a minus one phase according to the bitwise product of each of these terms here. Okay. So let's look a little bit more closely at what this exponent looks like here, this GHI term. So each of these GH and I are elements. There's some element, some row of this matrix here. And we can rewrite each of these GH and I in a little bit different form. So for example, I can take G and I can write it as a linear combination of just A times this odd weight row F star plus some vector that's in G0. Okay, so in the case that the element G is in G1, then A is equal to 1, and we get F star plus some element of G0. Right? And we can do that for H and I as well. And then we can expand out this, before we expand out the product, let me just remind you of the triorthogonality conditions. Okay, so the triorthogonality conditions just say that each pair of these vectors must have even overlap, and each triple must have even overlap. And so what this means is that when we expand out this product here, what we get is, well, the first term is just going to be this thing here, ABC times this F star vector. And this so this term has odd weight in the case that A times B times C equals 1, and of course it's 0 otherwise. But all of the rest of the terms in this expansion have even weight as a result of these triorthogonality conditions. And so the result is that we can just rewrite the Hamming weight of this is just equal to the product ABC, which is exactly what we wanted for a logical doubly controlled Z gate. Right? So this just becomes ABC, and can you take that outside of the product, and we get exactly this expression here, which defines the gate that we wanted. Okay, so the end result is that we have transversal Hadamard, we have transversal doubly controlled Z. So our original goal was for a universal set of transversal gates, and the reason that we wanted to do that was because this state distillation alternative is very costly. Okay. So the real question is, now that we have this universal set of transversal gates, does it actually do us any good? Right, so how do these triorthogonal codes actually perform in comparison to codes that require state distillation? So the answer is a bit murky, actually. It turns out that the studies of the threshold for the 15.1.3 code show that it's the threshold about 0.01%. So it's a very modest threshold. And compare that to, for example, a threshold for the surface code, which is about 100 times higher. Almost 1%. And of course, the performance is only going to get worse if you have, say, for example, locality constraints in your physical quantum computer, right? Because these thresholds are assuming concatenation of this code, which means that transversal application of these three qubit gates is just going to need interaction between qubits which are further and further apart. Okay, so the threshold. I mean, these extra constraints will only make the threshold worse. Now, we have a whole bunch of other triorthogonal codes which were constructed by Bravi and Ha, in particular this family of 3k plus 8 codes. Threshold hasn't been studied for those, so we don't really know what it is.
Sorry, do you know for sure that your technique won't apply for surface codes, or is it just an open question?
So for surface codes, H is transversal. Well, it depends on how you define the surface code. So let's say the surface code just encodes this. You just have a surface that encodes a single logical qubit. In that case, Hadamard is transversal. And CNOT is also transversal. So now it's the T-gate that's the problem. But here, this construction was using the fact that T-gate is transversal, and we can actually construct the Hadamard transversally, which was the hard thing to do. So it's not obvious to me that the same kind of thing would work. In particular, what you require for the T-gate is that, so remember I defined these code words as a superposition over some set of vectors. And what you need from those vectors is that they all have a particular Hamming weight. So for example, if they all have Hamming weight 8 or 0 mod 8, then a transversal T has the effect of just wrapping around. So a T is a pi over 4 rotation. And so if you do that 8 times, you just come back to 0. Right? It's trivial. So that's the kind of thing that we need from a code in order to get a transversal T gate. And you're not going to get that from the surface code. So this is something else you're going to have to take advantage of there if there was any hope of that.
So for the 15.13 threshold, is that an analytical lower bound, or is that a Monte Carlo estimate?
It's a Monte Carlo estimate. In fact, it's not even really, it's a pseudo-threshold estimate. But it's going to be relative. I mean, I wouldn't expect that the real threshold would be much different than that.
I mean, I'm kind of surprised, because the 7.13 code seems to have a somewhat lower threshold than that. It's not dramatically lower, but the 15.13 should be worse than the 7.13.
So again, so this is a pseudo threshold. So it's possible that this is even optimistic. I agree, right? I mean, you're using more physical qubits, and the error correction procedure is more complicated. So it should only be worse. I'm taking this number from a study by Cross, DiVincenzo, and Tirol from 2009.
Okay. So this number is for the 15.13 code with regular roll boring distillation. As opposed to your method.
Yeah, that's right. So, I mean, in this particular, the bottleneck for the threshold when you use distillation is normally the CNOT gate. So that basically this number really is it's the error rate at which an encoded CNOT, just one level of encoding of the CNOT gate, which that error rate is the same as the physical. I mean, it's like the break-even point for just one level of encoding. Normally, for a real threshold, you would need you need to know how it scales asymptotically.
Okay, but I guess what I was getting at is you've told us the threshold for boring roll distillation, but have you told us yet? I mean, how it compares if you recompute that threshold instead using?
Oh, I see. Using this scheme.
Yeah, yeah.
I have not done that. I would expect that the threshold for that is only going to be worse, right? Because now we have. We're dealing with, if you use the 15.13 code, you could just do T gates, I guess. But for a triorthogonal code in general, you're going to have these doubly controlled Z gates, which are three qubit gates, and which are even more complicated. Furthermore, this subtle point about the polyframe that I just mentioned earlier also makes it slightly worse. Normally, you don't have to actually make these X corrections to account for this minus one phase. But because of the way this scheme works, you would actually have to make those corrections. Those corrections could also be faulty themselves, right? So that's another reason why you might expect the threshold to be slightly worse.
But also, I would guess that they're taking into account the kind of ability to correct X for X errors, which you have to give up.
Yeah, that's possible. So I don't remember the details as to whether or not that would have mattered in this case. I'm sure that they were using the depolarizing noise model for this estimate. In which case, the extra protection for X errors would eliminate some of those, for example, Y errors. So that might explain some of the reason why this threshold could be higher than what you get for the 7-qubit code, I suppose. Okay.
This used less resources than if you do distillation where you have to try again and again and until you get the right.
So I think I guess what I'm doing now is an advertisement for people to study that. So the answer is I don't know. The hope is that yes, it is. There are some cases in which this is more efficient.
Naively, from what you said, I would guess the threshold might be slightly worse, but the overhead would be substantially better.
Problem is that you want to be below threshold in order to get some kind of nice, good scaling with resources. And so, if your threshold is 100 times better, as it is, say, for the surface code, roughly here, then even if state distillation is very expensive, the scaling, the resource scaling is going to be probably in your favor, right? Even though in this scheme we only need to use transversal gates. You have to really run the numbers, I think, and figure it out explicitly. What I'm trying to say with this slide is, it's certainly not clear to me that there's an advantage to this method. It's also not necessarily clear that it's worse. So maybe it's worth looking at more closely.
That's when they opened the door that people didn't think of that. Right. Usually Mandy is pretty careful. So that's...
Okay, so any other questions on this slide before I move on?
No, go ahead. I'll say something afterwards.
Okay, sounds good. Okay, so maybe before I move on to the next slide, this isn't quite the end of the story. So it turns out that even though the situation is a bit murky for actually using these codes for computation, ironically, it turns out that it's also helpful for the thing that we were trying to eliminate, state distillation. Okay, so we can use these triorthogonal codes and the result that the doubly controlled Z gate is transversal to actually help us with state distillation, believe it or not. Okay? So let me just briefly run through state distillation. So I don't have time to describe it in detail, but the main thing that you need to know is that in state distillation, the main goal is to prepare some resource state. And in particular, if you're trying to do state distillation for a T gate, the state that you want to prepare is ket plus followed by a T gate. Okay, so if you can prepare that state, then you're good to go. Now, the way that this is normally done is that you first encode ket plus into some error-correcting code for which T is transversal, apply the transversal T gate, which applies logical T, and then the assumption is that these T gates are relatively noisy. Okay, there's not a real good way to implement them. And so what you want to do is you want to be able to detect any errors that might happen in these noisy T gates. Then, assuming that you don't detect any errors, your output is the state that you wanted, but a less noisy version of the state that you would have had you not used the error correcting code. Okay? So the T gate is one example, but it's not the only kind of state that we can distill. You can also think about distilling, for example, Toffoli gates. And in this case, what you want is to prepare that state up there, which is essentially just ket plus on the 3 qubits. There's ket zero on the third, followed by a Toffoli gate. And so one way to do this is to express the Toffoli gate in terms of Clifford and T gates. And so then, you know, the assumption normally is that the Clifford gates are noiseless. We're using some other code to implement these Clifford gates, but that the T gates are noisy. And so what you do is you use state distillation to implement the T gates. So the cost of this Toffoli state is going to be 7 times the cost of distillation for a single T gate. And so this plot here just shows you the number of physical T gates that you need. So this is the very bottom level physical T gates for a target error rate that you want for your Toffoli gate to produce one Toffoli. Okay, so these numbers don't necessarily mean anything yet. It turns out that this procedure here is not the optimal one. In fact, just last year, Cody Jones and Brian Easton independently came up with some methods to improve on this on just this construction here. And so here's I'm not going to describe what those protocols actually look like, but these are the costs to produce an average Toffoli. So you can actually improve, it's roughly a factor of 2 or so over the sort of naive construction of this Toffoli gate. Okay. So I claim that you can use these doubly controlled Z gates for triorthogonal codes to also do Toffoli state distillation. And so here's the sort of basic form of the circuit. So what we're going to do is we're trying to prepare this state on the left. And so what we do is we encode the ket plus state for 3 different code blocks here. Then we perform the transversal controlled doubly controlled Z gate, which remember is equivalent to the Toffoli up to conjugation by Hadamards. And then we have these other Hadamards here. So that accomplishes, right, that prepares this state for us. And what this circuit does is, assuming that you detect no errors here, it actually outputs k Toffoli states for you, right, using 3k plus 8 physical qubits. And if you can then use this for distillation, and what happens is you get this curve here. So you can see it's pretty competitive. It's at least competitive with these other methods by Easton and Jones. And in some cases, it's actually substantially better, right? For example, here when you see these gaps. So I mean, it's sort of an ironic thing that, right, we can use these. We were trying to eliminate state distillation in the first place, and now we're end up right back at state distillation, but you know, we've done somewhat better than we could have done before, at least in terms of the number of T gates, right? Okay, so that's pretty much the end of the story then. Right, triorthogonal codes can be used to admit transversal implementations of the doubly controlled Z gate, and with the help of error correction, the Hadamard gate. And then also, you know, if you choose not to use that scheme for fault-tolerant computation, well, you could just use this to do state distillation. Just to take your pick, do whatever is your favorite. And so just I want to end on a couple of open questions and notes. So, I mean, there's a couple of obvious open questions. One is, what are the thresholds for triorthogonal codes? We don't really, I mean, with the exception of an estimate for the 1513 code, we don't really have a good grasp of what they are. Second, well, there are probably more triorthogonal codes out there. Can we find them? Are there better ones? And then the third open question is, well, are there other ways to eliminate state distillation? And so, you know, there are a couple of ways that I can think of that are sort of similar to the technique that I've shown you today. One is by Hector Bombin and Miguel Angel Martin Delgado. And they were investigating color codes in, you know, in some number of spatial dimensions. So their context was a little bit different. But the way that they actually get universality is pretty similar to what I showed you today. They use codes that admit transversal version of T and C naught. And then they actually use this plus state distillation right, to obtain universality. So it's sort of a subtle difference. But it's a similar kind of mechanism there. And then very recently, we have both of the authors in the room here, Thomas Joachim O'Connor and Raymond Laflamme, have proposed a different kind of scheme in which they use 2 different codes together, where one code admits a transversal implementation of one set of gates that's not universal, and then there's another code, in their case, the other code is a 15.1.3 code, which sort of implements the complementary set to get a complete universal set of gates. And the idea there is actually, at a high level, is sort of similar. They're giving up some amount of distance of the code in exchange for the ability to do these gates transversally. Okay. And so that's it. Thank you very much.
Further questions? So the fault-tolerant protocol you presented was for one logical qubit per block.
That's right.
But I mean, some of these prior orthogonal codes have many.
That's right.
So do you know what to do then? I mean, can you actually use those extra qubits?
Yeah, okay. So the answer is possibly. So if you look at this here. So this example is just assuming that there's a single odd weight row F. But if there's multiple F stars here, then what you're going to have is many of these terms which could be of odd weight. And so what's going to happen is the transversal version of doubly controlled Z is going to apply doubly controlled Z to every single one of the logical qubits, right?
Okay, that's what it does. Doesn't do some interaction between them.
No, that's right. So now let's see. So for the Hadamard gate, though, the Hadamard gate is going to be exactly the same, right? Because the logical operators in the tri-orthogonal code are symmetric, right? So you don't have individual addressability, but you have some, you have global addressability.
Those results at the end on Majesty distillation, mm-hmm. And that curve you showed.
Yeah.
So which tri-orthogonal code did you study for that?
I didn't talk at all about how we really did this. So I used the code. So there's a family of codes which has a parameter k, which is the number of encoded qubits. And now k has to be even. It's an even number up to however large you want it to be. So I picked the optimal code for k between, 2 and 100, I think is what I did. Right, so that's why this curve is a little bit more curvy than these other ones, is because we have a whole family of codes to choose from. Whereas these other methods are really just using a single code, and then they jump to the next level, right? So the next level of distillation. Whereas we can go a little bit more smoothly with the choice by varying this parameter k. Right, so there's no single code that I use to generate this plot, right? It was just, pick the optimal k for that particular set of error parameters.
Okay, so does that mean that you're like, okay, I want to reach this target error rate, I'm going to use this k code the whole way through, or do you switch like as you go along?
Also an excellent question. So you could do either. So what this plot is actually doing is at the very top level, I use some tri-orthogonal code, and I pick the optimal k. Now, at the next layer down, I have to figure out some way to implement these doubly controlled Z gates. What I actually do is I use this Jones 1 procedure to do that. That turns out to be better than just doing a completely recursive kind of procedure, just using tri-orthogonal codes. Right.
Okay, any further questions for us? This is a more general question, but when you have the CSS codes and you don't have the T gate, then everything is classically assimilable. Got its Mendel theorem.
Yeah, that's right, because you only have the flip-through gate.
So for this Reed-Muller code, when you don't have the Hadamard gate, is it known that everything is assimilable? Obviously, it's not a universal gate set. But.
Well, I mean, it depends on what you want to do. You have C0 gate, and you have this T gate. T gate is diagonal. The C0 gate is a classical gate. So if you start with a classical basis state, then you can only get classical basis states with some phase. So if you also throw in the ability to measure in different bases, then
okay. Good round of questions. So let's take a look again.